Did you ever read On the Road?
I hated the book. I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it.
Sometimes I'm walking on the ground, and I see right through the ground.
50 years after it was published, we are still trying to figure out Jack Kerouac's masterwork.
If you just give into it, it's going to overtake you in some way.
For the actor and director Sean Penn, The Road has been a powerful draw.
From the time I got my driver's license, I became a road junkie. I mean, I drove back and forth across the United States probably 15 or 20 times.
And the new road trip movie he's directed is called Into the Wild. It's based on the true story of a young guy who set off to live in the Alaskan wilderness with just a rifle and a bag of rice.
I don't want a new car. These things.
Okay. On the Road and Into the Wild. That's ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This month is the 50th anniversary of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and on today's show, we'll hear a few different takes on the novel that is still a huge cultural touchstone. But first, one young man's cross-country rite of passage road trip with a not-so-happy ending. In the early 90s, Chris McCandless was just out of college. He decided to sell everything he had and donate it all to charity and then hitchhike across America to Alaska to live alone in the wilderness, off the grid. John Krakauer told McCandless's haunting true story in the 1996 bestseller Into the Wild. More than a decade ago, at a cafe in Los Angeles, Sean Penn stumbled across Krakauer's book, and he told me he instantly knew he had to make a film out of it.
I grabbed it, had my lunch, went home, and ended up reading it cover to cover twice in a row, which brought me into the wee hours, and I went to sleep at some point and then got up the next day and started pursuing the rights to do it. Because what had happened was I felt like I'd stumbled on a story that had everything that I was looking for, everything that felt worth telling, not the least of which was the American landscape that I've had a lifelong love affair with, and a person using it to find their own authenticity and freedom. And so all of those things seemed ripe for a movie.
Wild.
Yeah.
Just, what are you doing when we're there? Now you're in the wild.
Just,
what are you doing?
You're just living, man. You're just there in that moment, in that special place and time.
Yeah.
Getting out of this sick society.
Our society!
Society, man!
Society!
Society! Society!
Society!
Society! You know? Society!
Even though his life ended truly tragically, you portray this journey as joyful and fulfilling. Am I wrong in imagining that you were identifying with that guy and that character deeply, personally?
Well, yes, his life did end tragically, but I also felt, and I felt it really from the first reading, that I was reading the story of somebody who had accomplished a very full life in a very short time, from the time of literally rebirthing himself and renaming himself and going on this journey that was much more pursuit than flight, in my view. That was something to be celebrated, and I think that the way that traditionally cultures have done it is that this was related to men in particular, this kind of rite of passage that takes people to a physical edge of their existence as well, because I think in that you find a humility that can only be found there.
Did you ever, as a young person or as a not young person, take a road trip like McCandless did and just set out?
From the time I got my driver's license, I became a road junkie. I mean, I drove back and forth across the United States probably 15 or 20 times. It was always the windy back roads and the motel that you could park your car 8 feet from your bed right outside the window. And I always loved that. And I always took a tent with me, and I'd throw it down in a reservation somewhere or in a campground somewhere, you know, intermittently. But not this kind of getting lost from all of the world.
This quest.
No, yeah. Not the same.
Did the simplicity and rudimentary nature of living that way appeal to you for the time you did it?
I think that if I didn't have kids, I would still be living that way. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I know in Alaska there's some controversy about whether McCandless ended up dying because he was reckless, because he had some death wish. You make the suggestion very clearly in this film that he had found what he needed to find, and he had grown up and had his rite of passage and was heading back to society. On what basis did you make that judgment?
Well, what you're referring to, that we call the Alaskan perspective. The Alaskan perspective is akin to the Minnesota driver visiting California telling you, oh, you guys have no idea how to drive on ice. And then you go to visit them in their hometown, and you get to the intersection, slide right through it with them at the wheel, because nobody I know knows how to drive on ice. So, you know, this is a guy who spent 113 days by himself in the Alaskan backcountry. To date, I've not spoken to or heard from a critic of Chris McCandless who's attempted that. This is an unforgiving place. And in many ways, he was very successful for a long time by any standard.
The character is idealistic in the extreme, and he walks the walk as well as talking the talk, like a lot of young people do. It seems to me I can see that kind of idealism in all of the non-artistic pursuits you do, and going to New Orleans to help people after Katrina, and I guess also in your various trips abroad to our various axes of evil that you've visited. Why do you feel compelled to do that, to go to Iraq, to go to Iran, to go most recently to Hugo Chavez's Venezuela?
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, the first thing that you can do once you start to strip things away is you become very aware that the term axis of evil doesn't apply, and that's someone else's term.
I was using it ironically.
No, I knew you were. But, you know, everything that I do, for better or worse in my life, from taking kids to Disneyland to writing journalism to making movies to sitting on my butt doing nothing, it's all kind of one thing to me. It's all just your responsibility. And of course, you know, for me, in all cases, something that I find some kind of passionate connection to that keeps me feeling alive.
But let me just follow up on Venezuela and Chavez, where your presence there with him seems to give a kind of seal of approval. And while arguably he's done good things economically, certainly politically and in terms of political liberty and stuff, he's not a good guy. Do you worry about how, oh, Sean Penn is going here, that's going to refract into what Americans see that means, that implies, about what you're saying about a guy who has his bad parts as well, I guess, as his good?
Well, you know, I mean, I think you make me think of the religious right who would be at odds with himself if they didn't feel his existence was showing a seal of approval of God. I mean, I went there as a journalist, and I think that the perception that I'm going is a seal of approval. It just has to do with the kind of pedantic thinking that is, you know, overwhelming us every day and not something that I pay a lot of attention to.
So you're really going to just explore, find out, yeah, in a journalistic fashion rather, yeah, than a Hanoi Jane fashion as it's been pictured?
Well, I frankly don't give a shit how it's been pictured. I know that I'm lied to every day in the newspapers in the United States and on television, and I'm not at peace with that. And I know that I've been able to go and give myself a front row seat and find out a great deal more of what is really happening in the world by traveling, and I'm going to continue to do that until I'm gone.
You have teenage kids now.
Mm-hmm.
How would you react if one of them said something like, or literally, that they were going to go off without a dime and just head out?
Well, I would have mixed feelings about it.
Good.
I imagine that will happen. If not to one degree, then to another. And I'm quite certain that it has to happen to one degree or another. Under our care as parents, there's this tricky thing about how much do we encourage of their at times dangerous pursuits, emotionally, physically. And I think that as long as those pursuits are not those that lead to numbing oneself from experiencing life or recklessly putting oneself in peril as the primary mission, that the only thing that you can do is encourage them. And I would say, you know, I can imagine that in many ways the difference between a great parent and a terrible parent to the young kid who wants to ride motorcycle and fly through the air in that saddle is one bad fall makes you feel a failure as a parent. And without that fall, you've supported the individuality and the dream and the passion of your child. So it's tricky.
And a matter of luck, as it was in McCandless's case.
Yeah.
In a way, and people will have to see the film, I think, to understand this, but even though it ends with this guy's death, it is the most, on a visual level, on a story level, the most purely pleasurable of the films you've directed.
Oh, good.
Does that? Do you think that, do you agree?
Yes,
does that reflect some change in you at 47 versus 30 and 35?
It's hard to say, you know. I guess what it is finally is, you know, E.L. Doctorow had this thing that he said that I've always held on to, that the artist's primary responsibility is to know the time within which he lives. And so working within that set of restraints or obligations, we then hope for the best. And so I think it has less to do with my personality changing than it has to do with recognizing that I'm not alone in looking for an alternate to the bling generation, to questioning the society's propaganda, to returning to some kind of, I don't mind saying, spiritual connection to life. And that seems fundamental, and it's, you know, and it's the gift that Chris McCandless leaves behind as a story worth telling.
Sean Penn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, it's a mystery to me. We have agreed with which we have agreed. And you think you have to want more than you need. Until you have it all, you won't be free.
Sean Penn's new movie, Into the Wild, will be in theaters this week. Coming up, the enduring appeal of Kerouac's On the Road. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
The solitude of the actual oneness of the unbornness of the unborn essence of everything. Comma? Nay, the true pure foreverhood. That big blank potential that can ray forth anything it wants from its pure store. That blazing bliss.
We're listening to Jack Kerouac, age 37, reading from his article called Is There a Beat Generation in 1959.
Why should I attack what I love out of life? This is beat. Live your lives out? Nah. Love your lives out.
Was Kerouac chemically altered at the time? Maybe. Or maybe he was just high on success.
But that wild eager picture of me on the cover of the book On the Road, where I look so beat.
2 years earlier, 1957, his novel On the Road had been published, and it was that rare thing, a cutting-edge work of art that was also an instant bestseller. On today's show, we are marking the 50th anniversary of On the Road. We asked two of our contributors, Hilary Frank and Jonathan Menjivar, a newly married couple, why the book still speaks to readers. But it turned out that Hilary had never read it. So Jonathan gave her his beloved copy with all his underlinings and scribbles from when he was 17.
So far, I'm not entertained.
What do you mean?
I'm on what? Page 109. And I just feel like nothing's happened, and he's heading on his way back to the East Coast because he's like failed at I don't even know what. I don't know what he was setting out to do.
But I think like the thing of it is that what happens doesn't really matter. It's more about this feeling, like if you just give into it, it's going to overtake you in some way. That was 3 weeks ago. I could see what Hillary was saying, but picking up the book now, I still fall for the way Kerouac puts words together. I thought my friend Davy Rothbart might be better at articulating what makes me like the book so much. Davy pretty much lives his life as if he's a character and on the road, touring the country every year, promoting this magazine he makes called Found. He stays on people's floors, in their basements, the side of the road.
When you wake up in like a little gully and there's kind of frost on the weeds around you and you just feel like rugged and I don't know, you feel cool. I mean, that's what part of On the Road is about and that's what part of some of the reason people seized on it. But I just don't think it's only a mythic allure. I think like it's real.
That right there. That gets to the heart of why I think On the Road, even with its flaws, is something special. There's an energy and a romance that I know Hill should get. Davy fell for the book in the same way I did when he was a kid. In a lot of ways, he felt like he was Sal Paradise, the character who's kind of Kerouac's proxy in the book. Sal was a writer.
He also is falling in love with girls, like every city they go to.
Right.
And that really matched my experience. I think for me, that was actually one of the most powerful things about the book. Sal's longing for girls and the way that he can spot somebody in some roller rink or in some bar or just walking down the street and just feel so overwhelmingly in love that it just makes his heart, you know, miserable.
I think that's one thing that a lot of women and certainly Hillary respond really negatively to. Sure, he's falling in love with all these women, but then he's leaving them all behind. Do you think you have to be a boy to really understand that?
I don't know. Like, yeah, maybe it is a sort of romantic thing that's not that cool if you're the girl that's left behind.
The thing is, it's not so much that I think it's uncool of him to be leaving girls behind. I think it's uncool that he's lusting after girls who are like 16 and younger. And I think it's uncool that Dean Moriarty, the character who's supposed to be the coolest, marries three women and kind of rotates between all of them. And he's actively looking for more women to sleep with on the side. That's your hero?
I mean, isn't everyone you look at that's cool? You're overlooking some major flaw?
That's my friend Molly Eigen. Back in high school, she was obsessed with On the Road. She even went on a road trip where she packed herself bologna sandwiches, just like Sal Paradise does.
I guess I wonder, like, why overlook their attitudes towards women? Did that stuff not bother you?
I remember being bothered by it, but I do remember thinking, like, I would be the woman that was, like, in with them. Like, I would be the one woman that they would be like, oh, I'll take her seriously, and she's not like the other women, and unlikely.
I think I figured out what the problem is. Jonathan?
Uh-huh?
I think I'm too old for On the Road.
What makes you say that?
Molly read it in high school. So did you. So did Davy. I think maybe it's just a teen thing. Here, let's do this. Let's go to a high school English class that's reading On the Road and see what actual teenagers think of it.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Hillary, that's not a real person. That's a TV show. It's Kim Kelly from Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, but Kim Kelly is exactly the kind of kid who should love On the Road. She drinks, she has sex, she doesn't give a damn. Let's talk to Rebecca Kirshner. She wrote Kim Kelly's lines in that scene.
It felt refreshing and cool for Kim Kelly to say that the book stunk because it's like you're so afraid to criticize great works of art that it's like, oh yeah, that emperor is not wearing clothes.
I figured Rebecca would be all rebellious like Kim Kelly and she'd commiserate with me.
She didn't?
Well, she's not in love with the book now, but she did like it in high school, so she gets why a lot of teens are into it. And she still sees something in it, too.
I don't know. It's sort of cute how... Okay, this is what it is. Like, how much of a rebel are you if you have time to sit down and type something up? I mean, You're not out getting drunk or having a knife fight. And, you know, whether you're Hemingway or you're Kerouac or something, it's like, well, yeah, but you're kind of nerds because you're writers, really, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
At that age, also, you're sort of testing different identities. And, like, every book is a way of being a different person.
Right. Hillary, I think I just want you to see what the high school me would have been moved by.
It's hard when somebody you really care about just doesn't get or like something that is really important to you.
That's my friend Davey Rothbard again.
You know, I know Hillary. She's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like anybody who has a curiosity about the people we share the world with is someone that would like this book.
I think that's a terrible attitude. It's a poor understanding of the book to just think it's a barometer of coolness.
John Leland wrote a book called Why Kerouac Matters. I figured he could help answer my biggest question about On the Road, why people like it so much when it just doesn't feel well written. One of the first things you learn in a creative writing class is show, don't tell. And to me, this book is all telling. I never feel like I'm put in the moment.
Yes, we have made an icon of a book that's unevenly written. But the descriptive scene of the brothel in Mexico, which becomes increasingly more hallucinatory as they go along,
mm-hmm.
I think is a really vivid scene.
And that's also one of the scenes that kind of turned my stomach, because that's the one where, you know, he's lusting after this 15-year-old girl.
But poor Sal, he's a step slow all the time, and there he is. He's in this brothel, and he still can't approach the girl that he's really interested in.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, I don't want to see him get the girl that he wants in that situation because she's so young.
And so he doesn't.
Right.
So, you know, you can go away happy that her her virtue, such as it is, remains uncompromised, at least by Sal Paradise.
Touché.
But also, don't think of it just as Dean's book. I mean, it's easy to read the book as this celebration of men behaving badly. But Sal keeps himself at a distance from Dean's behavior and really is able to put it behind him. Think of it as Sal's book in addition to Dean's book.
And what will I get out of that?
You'll get a book about the things that male friends go through. You know, they go through this sexual admiration. There's really a great love affair. They burn pretty hot, and then they get mad at one another, and they fall out, which I think men are never able to show in real life or in their depictions of their friendships.
Yeah, you know what's happening is that I'm starting to like the book more just from talking to you about it. You know, I think your interpretation of it is making me feel more fond of it.
Oh, good. Well, I'm not really trying to sell the book. That's not, that's not my job.
I'm not trying to sell the book to you either. It's not like I'm going to love you any less if you don't like it. I just want you to see that there are moments that are great.
Well, there's this one part that I marked. It's near the end, you know, when they're in Mexico, and Sal's trying to sleep in the car, and it's just way too hot in there. So he gets out of the car, and he gets on the roof, because he just wants to feel the cool metal on his skin. And he lies there on his back, and there's still no breeze, and the mosquitoes are eating him alive.
And what do you think of that?
Well, I guess it's this one moment where I can really feel what's going on with him. All he can do to get through that night is give in to the heat and the mosquitoes and kind of let his blood and the bugs become one. Right there, he really does what I want a writer to do.
Is it okay that it makes me happy to hear you say that?
Yeah, of course.
Hillary Frank and Jonathan Menjivar live in Philadelphia. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we're talking about On the Road. The year that Kerouac's book was published happened to be the same year that my family began its annual summer ritual of the long driving vacation across the country. To the Dakotas that first year, to Montana, to Canada, to the Deep South, to New England. Big station wagon, no seat belts, a silver trailer coming behind, two-lane blacktops, and brand new interstate highways. Another American family caught up in that same annual ritual around the same time were the Friedlanders. and Lee Friedlander, a photographer, used those trips to make a lot of the black and white images that established him as one of the most acute, celebrated modern chroniclers of America. Young Eric, the Friedlander son, grew up to become an innovative cellist. He has a new album of music inspired by those Friedlander family trips, all performed on solo cello. It's called Black Ice and Propane.
When I started writing the music, it had this Americana and this roots feel to it. And what I often do is just sit with the cello and kind of improvise and try to develop, like, if I have a good start, I want to figure out the rest of the song. And these memories started filtering back, these memories of these trips that I took with my family every summer, my whole life, practically. And the block ice was an obligation that you had to fulfill, because we had to get the big block of ice, because otherwise the food would go stale. Actually, the original title was Block Ice, Tongue, and Propane. My father, there was a stretch when he began preparing tongue in the pressure cooker for lunch almost all the time. And
Block Ice and Propane is the name of one of the songs. And since you are holding a cello,
I am.
Why don't you play it?
Okay, cool.
Very nice indeed. That was Eric Friedlander playing his song Block Ice and Propane off the album of the same name. Now, there's a bow sitting next to you, which you didn't use at all. That was entirely plucked. How common, or rather how uncommon, is it to have works for cello that are not bowed at all?
I think it's fairly uncommon. I think me, along with most people, consider the bow the primary voice of the cello, but I really wanted to turn it around because my first instrument was guitar before I picked up the cello, and I played a lot of folk guitar and blues and things like that. And so I developed a finger-picking style, And in the last 3-4 years, I've been trying to get better at carrying those techniques to the cello and see what might happen. I don't know. There's some really beautiful quality that you get from plucking the cello. It's kind of guitar-ish, but it's much warmer and darker.
You talk in the liner notes beautifully about this sort of magical memories of driving at night in particular.
Yeah, well, you know, we did something then, which I'm sure is completely illegal now, that you just can't do, is what my sister and I would ride. We had a camper shell that sat on top of a 66 Chevrolet pickup, and, you know, we sat above the cab looking out the big picture window of the camper and, you know, driving 65, 70 miles an hour
down
the highway.
Like Mitt Romney's dog.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and at the end of these trips, we would get to kind of like Ohio or somewhere like that, and it was just, let's hit the turnpikes and get home. And that meant driving late into the night and pulling over at truck stops and sleeping for an hour. And we would just sit up there kind of dozing and listening to the radio or playing games, but also turn out the lights and just look out that window. And this is the magic of night driving. I still have a feeling for that now.
And the song on this record, Night White, is inspired by that set of memories.
Yeah.
Record, there is a fairly radical bipolarity, if not variety, between these sort of beautiful American rootsy songs like the one you just played and a song called Yakima. And then there's these dissonant modern pieces as well, seemingly from, I mean, they could be from two different records. What appeals to you about doing both things?
I wanted to carry a technique I started with my first record, which was to improvise live in the studio and bring that kind of on-the-spot feeling to the record. So I did that, and I really like the way the contrasts work because it gives you a kind of darker place to go, and where from when you exit that area and back into the kind of sweetness of the plucked pieces, you feel kind of refreshed and ready to hear one of those again.
Well, we're going to take you up on that. And we warned you that we were going to ask you to improvise something, but you don't know what I'm going to ask you to improvise off of.
That's true.
It is from Jack Kerouac's On the Road, early on in the book, and I will read it. A guy with a kind of tool shack on wheels, a truck full of tools that he drove standing up like a modern milkman, gave me a ride up the long hill, where I immediately got a ride from a farmer and his son heading out for Adel in Iowa. In this town, under a big elm tree near a gas station, I made the acquaintance of another hitchhiker, a typical New Yorker, an Irishman who'd been driving a truck for the post office most of his work years and was now headed for a girl in Denver and a new life. I think he was running away from something in New York, the law, most likely. He was a real red-nosed young drunk of 30 and would have bored me ordinarily, except that my senses were sharp for any kind of human friendship. He wore a beat sweater and baggy pants and had nothing with him in the way of a bag, just a toothbrush and handkerchiefs. He said we ought to hitch together. I should have said no, because he looked pretty awful on the road. But we stuck together and got a ride with a taciturn man to Stewart, Iowa, a town in which we were really stranded. Very cool. Thank you very much. That was Eric Friedlander improvising a song that you, he, and I heard for the very first time, inspired by Jack Kerouac's, or a passage of Jack Kerouac's, On the Road. Why did you decide to pick up the bow rather than pluck for that piece?
You know, when you mentioned Kerouac, I thought it was going to be a little more brash, the period, and a little more, the passage, a little more aggressively with that kind of dark humor. And it really was kind of a sweet passage and had a lot of warmth to it. And it really captured that kind of mile after mile feeling you can get when you're driving in the United States. So that's kind of, in the end, what I was after.
Well done. Eric Friedlander, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you.
Eric Friedlander's new record is called Block Ice and Propane, and you can find out more about it and about Eric at studio360.org. Coming up, if highway signs look fuzzy, don't fidget with your glasses. Get a new sign.
Opening it up, widening the typeface, there are minuscule changes, but they could be seen at 900 feet.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Early road signs were not uniform. They were hand-painted mostly on wood and all in capital letters because lowercase was hard to render with a paintbrush. As federal highways became standardized, so did the signs, but with very little thought given to the design. And now, as drivers get older and their headlights brighter, the original typeface looks increasingly fuzzy. That's where graphic designer Don Meeker comes in. In this week's Design for the Real World, he explains how he helped bring highway signs back into focus.
In President Eisenhower's term, they said, we need standard highway signs nationwide because we have these new freeways. So we can take a missile from Altoona, PA to Albuquerque really very fast. It's kind of funny to hear. The reason for that highway system was to mobilize the country in the Cold War.
What's wrong with this picture? The common, everyday spectacle of modern traffic on roads that are as out of date as the covered wagon.
For the freeway signs, there was a new development, a mixed case typeface. It was developed by a man named Ted Forbes from Leroy Lettering. Well, Leroy Lettering, an engineer and architect, will remember, was used to label drawings. So he made these letters, blew them up photographically, and created a typeface. That's all he knew. That's what was available to him in 1949. And from that came Highway Gothic Series E Modified. The astonishing thing is that that has lived for 58 years.
I've been traveling this road a long, long time. I'm starting to get the blues.
The roadscape, however, has become much, much more complex. The two-lane freeway is now a four-lane freeway. Urban driving, the old rural route out of town, now is filled with all sorts of commercial clutter.
Road signs and middle lines are hypnotizing me.
So I think the competition for your eye has become greater, yet the side of the road where you place signs has not become wider.
Road signs and middle lines will be the death of me.
There's no reason why we have to be living. If computers were regulated like highway signs, we'd still be living with vacuum tubes. Intel would be making vacuum tubes. They wouldn't be making microchips. And so in the late 80s, the federal government became aware that the driving population was getting older. They were also aware of these new high-brightness materials and the halation effect. Well, the halation is when your headlights shine into the material, it reflects back to you. So if that is not properly balanced for your eye, the white will be so much more intense that it will overshadow the letter form or become much too bright. And the sign can be a big glare, which they can't discern what they're reading. So the flaw of the standard E-modified, the upper-lowercase typeface that you see on freeway signs, is that it has a consistent stroke width. It's like strapping two pencils together and pulling them around in a full circle. That makes the interior shapes or the counters of the typeface very small. It is quite squat, short, and quite heavy. There were a number of studies done, and the final results were just make everything 20% larger. Well, a 20% larger cap high increases the size of the sign by 50%. Were it possible, the cost would be in the billions.
What's a citizen going to do?
And so we looked at the typefaces and realized finally that we were going to have to start from scratch.
Our American dream of Futurama on wheels can come true.
This is something we'd never done before.
Our highway engineers know the way. It's ours for the asking.
And we drew the initial version of Clearview. We opened up the terminals. That is, unlike a Helvetica, where the E curls around on itself and completes the circle, the letter terminates with a straight, nearly straight stroke. So you don't create a trap for light because your eye closes a word up at great distances. And it worked. Different typefaces have different voices. They can be delicate, they can shout, and in this case with Clearview, the voice of it is as the invisible umpire. It has to make a good call. This 20% gain in legibility for the same size sign has saved many lives.
I can see clearly now, rain has gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright, bright sunshine day.
Don Meeker is a graphic designer. You can see some examples of the highway typefaces he talked about at studio360.org.
I think I can make it now, all the pain has gone.
Derek John produced our story.
All of the bad feelings have disappeared. Here's the rainbow I've been praying for. It's gonna be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. Look all around, there's nothing but blue sky. Look straight ahead, nothing but blue.
When producer Tanya Katenjian crisscrossed the country recently in a beat-up old Subaru, she talked to a lot of strangers. But this wasn't just roadside small talk. I asked her what her strategy was. What did she want from all these strangers?
Well, I asked them what are five things that make them happy and what do they think happiness is. There were lots of studies coming out at the time about happiness. Psychologists and psychiatrists were moving away from studying depression into studying the opposite. So I thought it would be a good way of kind of approaching people and getting them to think about what makes them happy.
Had you ever been around America that extensively?
Never. And I highly recommend it. I think if you're an American, it's imperative because it's such a gorgeous country. I mean, yes, America has its faults, but really the land itself is pretty amazing. And there's lots of surprises. You know, the sky really is huge in Montana, and the hills really are lush in Wisconsin, and the attitude is really different in the South.
Well, without further ado, let's listen to the chronicle of your incredible, 6,000-mile trip around America?
6,000 miles around America. More than that, actually, because with the back roads, I think it was 7,500 miles.
Let's listen.
Happiness.
Happiness.
Happiness?
That word is too vague.
It doesn't take much to make me happy.
When you say I'm happy, I don't know whether you mean I have an overall sense of well-being.
It's just a feeling of joy.
Or are you in a euphoric mood?
Being in love.
There's so many different kinds of enjoyable emotions, that the word happiness doesn't tell us very much. All it says is it's not unhappiness.
Something inside that makes you smile is how I would define it, something intangible.
You know, just be yourself all the time. Yeah, be happy.
I have downgraded myself sufficiently to appreciate, you know, even a squirrel nibbling on a nut makes me happy.
A person's life satisfaction or general happiness with their lives is better predicted by the number of good things that happen to them than by the intensity of the good things that happen to them.
Nice rainstorm, nice gentle breeze.
In other words, the prescription is if you want to be a happy person, you should have lots of little good things distributed throughout your day rather than one really great big thing.
Well, just have lots of horses and more hay.
A wonderful woman, a nice warm bed, good meal, and good friends. If you got that, you got the world. So what more do you need? That's right.
How many people are saving up for, you know, the big vacation or the Ferrari or the house? We tend to want to spend our money on some monumental, gigantic thing that we hope will give us a huge happiness hit. And it might, but it won't last long. That money might be better spent on very small things that make us a little bit happy.
Having a picnic every day and a party every night and always smile and have a good time and never meet a stranger.
If you really want to invest in the things that will make you happy, you invest in social relationships. Because all the data I've seen, the best predictor of people's happiness is the extent of their familial and friendship networks and the goodness of those networks.
Yeah, my wife is right there smiling at me. That makes me happy. That's the most important thing in my life right there.
We know for sure from decades of research in social psychology that once people make irrevocable, inescapable commitments, their psychological immune systems turn on in a way that they were not on before. And that's one of the primary reasons why we don't date forever, we marry. It's one of the primary reasons why we don't rent forever, we buy. On and on and on. Because the moment you're stuck with something, you suddenly, the mind gets creative, it goes shopping for ways to love what it can't undo. But as long as you can undo things, the mind shops for ways to undo them. That's why we find fault with the people we're dating, but once we're committed to them in a way that makes it very hard to dissolve the relationship, those flaws seem remarkably unimportant. My girlfriend and I have lived together for 13 years, and we got married last month. I'm just amazed at what a better human being she has become in the last 30 days. All those little things that used to annoy me and make me wonder if maybe I was in the right relationship, I now realize are tiny little freckles on the most wonderful person I could ever be with. It's just amazing how much sense this ring has made of my psychology.
In a journal, write a few things about what you were grateful for that day.
Smell the ocean.
Or things that made you a competent person that you're proud of having done that day. Just little things like that can not make the glass entirely full, but can make a difference, can make us feel happier.
Well, just letting it lay back and letting it go, I guess, huh? Right?
That works for me.
Yeah, works for me.
I think if more people just sat for a moment and asked, is this the life I've meant to live? Is this really the thing that's going to bring me what I want? Or am I just going with the tide? Am I just doing what I see everybody else doing? Am I being programmed by all the media around me that are telling me what to want? I can't finish that sentence because I don't remember if it started with a noun or a verb. But I feel happy.
Tanya Katenjian produced that story. If you haven't visited our website recently, you may be surprised to find that we have a new, friendlier way to listen to everything we've ever broadcast and a way now to tell us what you think about the show online. Please do. That is all at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and please listen next week as well. Our program is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Deanna Kashani,
Jillian Goodman,
Kevin Ryan.
And our theme music is by David Van Teagle.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, I become a character in a video game.
I shouldn't shoot at the other blue people, right?
Yeah, shoot at the red guys. Oh, that's a cameraman I'm shooting.
This is Kurt Anderson, and I go online inside the violent video game Halo.
Are you hearing the other gamers?
I am hearing the other gamers.
Okay.
As we kill them.
Yes.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.